Florida's new laws, collecting Jewish history, and the story of the highwaymen. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, this week, a handful of new laws took effect in Florida. They range from new voting rights for some felons to an increase in minimum wage. How will these laws impact you? We're going to go through all of them today. Also, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington is racing to collect as many stories and items from an aging generation. We'll meet the woman who has taken the challenge to find Holocaust survivors in South Florida and save their history. And the story of the Florida Highwaymen. They're a group of African-American Florida artists, mostly from Fort Pierce, who painted tens of thousands of landscape paintings over decades. People like former Governor Jeb Bush and former First Lady Michelle Obama own some of these paintings. We're going to learn more about them and the exhibition coming to Palm Beach County this weekend. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Minimum wage, workers' compensation, and voting rights for felons. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, a new year means a host of new laws were passed in Florida, several of which could affect your taxes, your paycheck, and maybe even your ability to vote. Well, joining us now with an update on new Florida laws and federal laws impacting Floridians is Jim Saunders, executive editor of the News Service of Florida. He's joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Jim, such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
All right, so let's start with the minimum wage. We're going to go through all of these, only a handful, but big ones. There's going to be a slight increase. It's going to $8.46 an hour. That's from $8.25. What set this increase in motion?
Back in 2004, Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment that requires the minimum wage to tick up every year with inflation. So this is part of a series of increases over the years. Like you said, it's going up 21 cents an hour for someone who makes minimum wage, which obviously isn't a lot. But the federal minimum wage is $7.25. So Florida minimum wage workers do make more than many in other states.
And of course, one of the things is we've seen such a push over the last few years to try to boost the minimum wage up $15 an hour. But I mean, all of those efforts, have they played a role in any way, or are we just going by every year it'll be a small uptick?
Well, at this point, it's just a small uptick. But John Morgan, the Morgan & Morgan attorney, who in 2016 passed the medical marijuana constitutional amendment, has formed a political committee that could put try to get a measure on the 2020 ballot that would lead to much larger minimum wage increases. His concept is to raise it to $15 over a period of years. Now, he has a long ways to go to get it on the ballot. It require probably, I'm not sure what the number is going to be for 2020, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 800,000 petition signatures. But Morgan showed with the medical marijuana amendment that he can get it. He knows how this works. So if he's willing to put up his money and continue forward, we could be seeing Florida voters, voting on that issue next in 2020. That'd be a huge issue on the ballot if it goes. And like you said, I mean, it's been something the $15 minimum wage has been popping up in various places across the country.
Yeah. Let's move over to workers' compensation insurance. The rates decline. How much?
It's going down 13.8% on average for businesses. You know, workers' comp insurance has been sort of a long, tortured issue in Florida for businesses and trial lawyers and labor unions. And the issue has been just fraught with political conflict over the years. But businesses have gotten breaks over the past couple of years. Like I said, as of Tuesday, the average rate was going down 13.8%. And last year, it went down 9.5%. So that's a little bit of good news for businesses, although this is a really controversial issue in Tallahassee. And I mean, just workers' comp in general. And I think we may see some more debate on that during the legislative session.
And, what are the factors involved in that decline? I mean, are just less people getting injured on the job?
Yeah, they're saying that the number of claims have gone down. One of the big issues of contention is attorney's fees in workers' comp cases. That's the type of thing that's been the most controversial issue over the years, and I think it may reemerge as we're already seeing some signs that could reemerge. But at least in the past couple of years, the workers' comp market, in terms of claims and you know, how much the insurers are having to pay out, has actually been pretty healthy, I think. So again, it's an issue that has a lot of special interests that watch it very closely.
So all but one of the constitutional amendments passed, in this last election, and a couple of them went into effect this week. The others will be going into effect soon. One of the most scrutinized controversial amendments, this one being watched nationally, of course, restoring of voting rights to millions of Florida or many of Florida felons. What do we know about how this is moving forward, though?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to watch over the next week what happens with this Amendment 4. Technically, it doesn't take effect until Tuesday, January 8th. But there is a lot of question out there about whether felons who have served their sentences will be able to start registering to vote immediately. There are supervisors of elections out there who are saying that they're registering people and will register people. But there's also some discussion, including from the new governor, about whether the legislature will have to come in and pass legislation to essentially carry out the amendment, which isn't unusual with other constitutional amendments in the past. But there's a question about whether felons should be able to register to vote immediately, or whether the legislature would have to do something first. If that's the case, the legislature doesn't go into session until March. So we could be looking at May before the legislature even passes anything. And this, too, has been an issue that has been politically fraught for years and years and years. And I think there's a lot of supporters of Amendment 4 who are worried that if the legislature starts trying to pass something to implement the constitutional amendment, that it could water it down. I think if felons are not allowed to start voting next week, we could see some court cases popping up pretty fast. People are watching this really, really closely.
Yeah, this one is getting a lot of national attention. There was also Amendment 2, which puts a new limit on non-homestead property taxes. Would that impact folks filing their taxes for 2018, or is this property tax for renters and homeowners next year?
Actually, this is an extension or making permanent a tax break that was passed maybe 10 years ago. Basically, they passed this amendment so that nothing would change. It caps at 10% the amount your assessed value can go up each year if you own a business or a commercial property, something that isn't subject to homestead exemptions. But the reason that this amendment was on the ballot was that it was going to expire. This tax break was going to expire. So they put it on the amendment to extend it to make it permanent. The realtors were very big supporters of this. I mean, they put millions of dollars into this campaign because, the real estate industry did not want to lose this tax break because values could go up very fast and tax bills could gone up very fast if the amendment had not passed.
We're talking with Jim Saunders. He's the executive editor of News Service Florida. We're looking at key Florida laws that are going into effect. Some already this week have gone into effect. He's joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. So, Jim, a number of constitutional amendments that have passed have a little bit of a longer timeline for implementation. But what do we know about the indoor vaping ban and the end of greyhound racing in the state?
Yeah, the constitutional amendments that passed, which were 12, they come into effect at various times. But the vaping amendment, don't ask me the number off the top of my head, which amendment number that was, because there were so many of them. But that has to be in effect by July 1st. That is one where the legislature is pretty much empowered to come in and pass some sort of bill to carry it out. And I have a feeling that will, involve some technical issues about what is a workplace where people won't be able to vape. What are the types of locations those are? So that one looks like it's going to be July, sometime by July 1st that will take effect. The longer term, Voters overwhelmingly approved this an amendment to end dog racing at pari-mutuel tracks. But that won't really kick in until 2020. They've given them some time for this to take effect. I think the Greyhound industry hate the amendment, but they like the fact that they have a little bit of time for this to play out. Pari-mutuel industry probably likes that. It helped them, make some decisions. But that one, they're going to keep racing dogs for the next year, at least, into next year. Before that takes effect.
Yeah, January 1st was also the deadline in staying in politics, and what's coming up with the legislative session, which again, as you mentioned, starts in March, is they're going to have to look now at this Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission report, because January 1st was the deadline for that report. Briefly, what are a few of the key points from the report submitted this week that lawmakers are going to have to tackle?
Yeah, I mean, this is a 446-page report or something. It's huge. One that's gotten a lot of attention already and I think is going to spur a lot of debate is whether teachers should be allowed to be armed in schools. They would have to be this commission recommended that trained teachers be allowed to be armed in schools. A law that was passed after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, the shooting, It allowed certain people described as guardians, which are sort of non-teachers, to be armed on school grounds. But this commission's saying teachers should be able to. This was a huge issue of debate last year after the shooting when the legislature was rushing to pass a bill on, to address school safety, whether teachers should be allowed to be armed or not. And this commission is saying they should be. So I think that's going to sort of refuel that debate, if you will. There's a lot of other issues in the report about trying to make schools safer and taking steps to secure school buildings and increase funding and those sorts of things. So I think the legislature starts committee meetings next week, and I know there's going to be some discussion of school safety already at that point.
And have you heard from any lawmakers about this report? I mean, it just came out a couple of days ago, but have you heard from anybody?
Not since it was finalized. We have not. Particularly the guns with teachers issue, you can be just guaranteed people are going to line up on either side of that issue and battle it out, because it is it was highly debated this during this past session.
Yeah, so busy week ahead next week, because in Tallahassee we've got newly elected officials taking office, the new governor, everybody else taking their post. What are some of the highlights for next week that we should be watching?
Well, Tuesday is the inauguration day, and Governor-elect DeSantis will take office. So will the new agriculture commissioner, Nikki Fried, as well as the new attorney general, Ashley Moody, and Jimmy Patronis, the state CFO, will stay in office. There's going to be a lot of hoopla about that. I mean, you got things from, the inaugural ball and so on. But, it'll be interesting to see Ron DeSantis, what he says at these events, because he's not been a Tallahassee insider, a state person. So it'll be interesting to see the direction he wants to take the state. The other thing, a really big thing to watch next week, really in the coming days, is that DeSantis is going to have the power to appoint three new Supreme Court justices, Florida Supreme Court justices. And it's going to shift the court dramatically to the right, I think. So we're all kind of waiting to see what he's going to do with that. Three longtime justices, Barbara Pariente and Fred Lewis and Peggy Quince, have to retire next week because of a mandatory retirement age. And they are part of a liberal bloc in that court. And DeSantis he has the power to appoint three new justices. And it, by all signs, they're going to be pretty conservative. And it's going to really change that court, change a lot of things in state government.
A lot to watch in the coming week. Jim Saunders, yeah. Executive editor of News Service Florida, again, joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Jim, a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
And again, if you want to know more about what those laws are, we'll be posting up on our website, WLRN.org. And by the way, just to mention that tomorrow on the Florida Roundup, we're going to have a fuller discussion into the year ahead in politics. That's at noon on WLRN. And the South Florida Roundup at 1 o'clock, they're going to do a deep dive into the major into the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Report that we just talked about. All right, still to come, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, collecting history. They need your help. We'll tell you how you can. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The generation of Jews that lived through the horrors of the Holocaust is rapidly fading. There's a greater sense of urgency now to find those survivors and their families and to gather as many stories and personal items to protect all of that for historical reasons. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington is collecting those stories, and they need your help. And if you have stories or personal items, they want to know because they want to protect that history. Amy Rubenstein is the South Florida curator for the Memorial Museum, and she joins us now in studio. Amy, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We also want to note that WLRN's Katie Swatowski is going to be doing a story, too, on this topic. That airs on Monday here on WLRN, so stay tuned for that as well. How did you end up in this position as the curator? Basically, Amy, you're going around trying to find this history and collect it to protect it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I was trained as an art historian in London, but I grew up as a granddaughter of three Holocaust survivors. So throughout my professional experiences, the Holocaust has been something that's part of my personal identity. So when the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum actually reached out and contacted me to start this position for the first time here in Florida, I said yes right away. They knew that there was a clear demand to have someone based in Florida for the museum. And the reason for that is because South Florida has one of the largest communities of Holocaust survivors here.
How do you describe the importance of your job? Because, I mean, really, when you think about it, you know, as I mentioned, this is a generation that is very quickly, this is part of that generation that fought in World War II, and it's fading away. And we need to really race to collect all of this history or it's gone for good.
Yeah, it can't be overstated that this is more than just a job. We as historians are collecting individual stories, like you said, and artifacts in order to continue telling the story for future generations when we don't have eyewitnesses anymore. As time passes, we lose survivors who can tell us their personal experiences of survival and tell the stories of the people who did not survive. So as time passes daily, the importance of my work and the importance of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum only increases.
You, as you mentioned, you have a very personal connection to this, as you have relatives who were there, who experienced the horrors. For your generation, I mean, how do you view, the Holocaust? And what do you think about your generation and how it views the Holocaust? You have a personal connection, but I'm curious about how the younger generations think about it.
Well, I think for me, it's obviously personal. It's part of my own identity and my own story. And I think a lot of people who are third generations of Holocaust survivors feel that it's a personal story. But we're very aware that that story is starting to fade. The ability to talk to eyewitnesses is fading. And I think that I'm in a unique point in time where I can both realize that I can reach out to a survivor and ask them what happened, but I'm also aware that those survivors are in their 80s, 90s, or have already passed away. So I think, again, as time moves on, future generations will have a further link to a personal connection. But what I do is try to capture those personal, intimate stories rather than just textbook facts, because I think that future generations who are online using online databases and online archives in schools can now use the museum's archive in school, as well as just look on their phone, check out the museum's website and database, and learn more information about their own family.
As you were growing up, I mean, you know, were your relatives open about sharing these stories? Because I know sometimes, as you're going to also tell us, is, you know, when you're finding survivors or families, that sometimes people don't want to open up. They don't want to talk about this.
Yes, I would say that because my own family has survivors from the Holocaust, I'm very, very aware that everyone deals with trauma and tragedy differently. I think that's the main point, really, that as time moves on, there's more information and more access to information.
But did your relatives, were they open about it? Did they share?
When I was younger, no. I think there's a lot of care and attention to protecting younger generations from atrocities. I think that's how we, you know, care and keep a lot of young and younger generations feeling safe and confident and secure when they're younger. But yes, as I got older, I did speak to my grandmother about her experiences, and I started to look for more information myself. And I think that that's something that a lot of people talk about, that as these survivors are getting older, even though a lot of them might have never spoken about what happened, now as they're really meeting their last days here, they're saying, I want to talk about it now. Someone just actually called me about a week ago and said, I'm 93 years old. I survived and I haven't shared my story. Will you come and record it? Will you listen to the story? So that's an incredible thing that the museum is now starting this dialogue with many people who have actually never talked about it before.
What's the process? I mean, you talked about somebody reached out to you, but what's the process in finding people and then verifying who they are and all of the, whether it's stories or items that they want to share, making sure that, you know, that you have the authenticity that's there, because that's important.
So we have a very basic process that can be followed, and we try to be very aware that it can be emotional for many people. So we try to keep it as basic as possible, starting out from, we actually have a lot of people who know about the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and contact us and say, I live in Florida. Can someone come and meet with me? From there, I always try to ask the survivor or their relatives for what the story is, where their family was before, during, and immediately after the war. Biographical information that can actually be very emotional for many people. But I try to have that initial conversation before meeting with them so that we have a dialogue started between us and some a comfortable conversation starting between us. And then I try to look at the artifacts before meeting with survivors, and it can be sent to me pictures via email. And once I meet with a survivor or their relative in person, I do some preliminary research to authenticate the objects and really capture the biographical information about the family tree and the family story. And once it's been completely acquired and donated to the museum in DC, then everything will be digitized, put on the museum's collection database online.
Do you go in thinking about what kind of items you're looking for?
Yes. I try to know what I'm going to see before I go, but I encounter time and again that someone will say, I actually have this paper in a drawer in the other room. Do you want to see it? And it turns out to be a handwritten letter from the 40s from a Jewish ghetto. Or I'll be prepared to see an original pre-war photograph. And then someone will say, I also have this photograph of my family on a boat that they immigrated on. So there's always an element of surprise, which as a historian is magical. Because I know that these objects age just like people do, and we need to preserve them and properly preserve them, really. But when I go in, I'm usually specifically looking for original family photographs, handwritten letters, any type of immigration document, and any other type of passport, identification card. I really try to talk to the person before I meet with them. Just so that I do have some sort of preparation.
Now, what is it like for you as you're sitting there listening to people share their stories? And these are horrific stories. You know, you have a job to do. You got to collect the history, but you're a human being and you have a personal connection to this. What's that like for you?
I feel like I should have a moment to pause, because it really is such a heavy and important mission in a way. The way that I prepare is knowing as much about the person before I meet with them and having that conversation on the phone. But truly, it's about being a people person. And because it is personal, I feel like I'm receptive to the emotional cues and nuances of, I don't want to talk anymore, or I'm about to tell you something very important and I'm very alert, or just being very aware and sensitive, and also respectful. There's definitely boundaries that I say as soon as I arrive. If there are certain things you don't want to talk about, or you rather talk about later, or you rather talk about on the phone, please feel free to know that I'm here to only help preserve and rescue these objects. I'm not here to do anything more than capture your family story.
Again, I'm talking with Amy Rubenstein, the South Florida curator for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and we're talking about collecting history, the stories and personal items from survivors and their families of the Holocaust. And you can find out more, by the way, on our Facebook Look up WLRN Sundial. We do have a link there, actually, to the Memorial Museum, and they have information if you want to reach out to them, because maybe you have a story or something that you want to share. That information is there for you in ways to contact somebody. So please check that out, again, on our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial. So as I mentioned before, our reporter Katie Switalski is working on a story on this as well. And she found some fascinating stories of survivors. And here's one. She had spoken to a gentleman, Peter Tarjan. And this is a gentleman who started a group, back in 1990, called the South Florida Child Survivors of the Holocaust. And again, this is the part of the story that she's going to be putting out next week.
Letters which my grandmother wrote to her daughters on stationery that she inherited from her uncle, second-hand stationery. My dear Agita, at last, finally, we got some news from you. I was very afraid that you had some troubles, and that's why you didn't write. You're right, my dear Aggie, that it would be wonderful to see each other, but I don't have the energy to hope.
So again, that is Peter Tarjan. There was another person that she had also collected the story from. This is from Haya Cohen, a daughter of a Holocaust survivor, about the lack of discussion that she had had with her parents about their experience.
I didn't realize that I should ask question. I was only 17 when my father died. Then life took over, and I never really asked much.
I know that there has to be a sensitivity, a respect of like, look, you don't want to share. You don't want to share because, I mean, again, these are just horrors beyond imagination. But for the sake of protecting history and passing this on to other generations and passing not just the memories, it's about passing on lessons. Do you ever find yourself in a situation where you have to find a way to get somebody to open up? Because maybe it's more important to preserve the history than just lose it?
Yes. I think of myself as a guide in a way where I can guide survivors or guide their children or grandchildren and tell them that while this might be difficult, we are going to create a digital legacy of your life. I'm not the only person who will hear it after today. Once you tell it to me, I'm going to now transmit it to Washington, D.C., and it will live in our collection for future generations and really forever.
And how often do you run into people who are hesitant?
I think everyone has a bit of hesitancy as well as a very clear, you can almost sense their need or their desire to tell what they want to tell, and you can tell on their face that they are about to share something that was both momentous and probably a lot of trauma involved.
I wondered if there's something, a story or maybe an item that you've come across, and you've been in the position for a little bit, for just a short while, but you know, I'd imagine that you've run into so many fascinating people. Is there any one moment, story or item that just was so surprising or stunning, like, oh my God, I can't believe that I'm seeing this?
I have to say I feel that way every single time I meet someone who's donating historical artifacts. And the reason I say that is I've been working as the acquisitions curator here in South Florida since April. And I think the most important piece that I've learned that's been surprising is not just one artifact, but the range of artifacts. The fact that living in South Florida, there are so many people right here in our community that have a link to the Holocaust, not just to World War II, but specifically to the Holocaust. And I find that with every object, every photo or postcard or passport from a concentration camp or immigration paperwork from the Dominican Republic or Cuba or Japan, there's just such a global connection for so many people here in South Florida. So rather than tell you just one artifact, to me, the most fascinating thing has been the range of experiences. I think growing up, at least for me personally, in a lot of the Holocaust education programs, you learn about the Yellow Star or you learn about the textbook dates and facts and countries. But what I'm trying to do and what the museum as a national institution is trying to do is further the education of individual stories. It's a better way to humanize the information that is honestly indescribable. So yeah, I think it's just really the range of objects.
You know, I think about conversations that I've had with survivors as well over the years, and really, especially over the last couple of years, is this kind of this shock that you had, the, you know, World War II, you had the Nazis, you had the Holocaust, this unreal anti-Semitism, and yet now we live in an era where we'd like to think that we've all advanced as societies, and yet no. There's still anti-Semitism is still rampant. It's still a big problem. From the people you talk to, you know, what have you heard about, you know, what they see today compared to what they were seeing back then?
It's a hard question and a good question. I think there's a lot of fear. I think a lot of survivors know firsthand experiences what it was like before the war. And that element of fear was very much present for many families, which is why so many families actually moved and immigrated from specific European countries before the war. And I think, speaking of today, it just makes it clear that my job is so important. The demand and the urgency of speaking to eyewitnesses right now, as anti-Semitism is rising, as you said, it feels more important and more urgent right now.
If somebody believes they may have something, and maybe it's a family member, maybe it's, you know, stuff that was in a box in an attic, and, you know, maybe that family has passed on, but they think, hold on, I might have something here. What do you tell them? What's the advice as to how they should go forward with that?
First of all, I'd love for them to contact me. They can email me or call me. We also have a Southeast Regional office in Boca Raton. So it's good to know that we have a base for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Boca, but I actually go to people's homes, and I think that's the first thing that I tell a lot of people. You don't have to go too far. I actually will come to you. I will come and review the photos or letters or whatever you might have in a storage bin in your garage. And once you contact us and we arrange a time to meet, the process will go. I really follow your lead. If you're interested in donating, we can talk about the process for donating the materials. If you're simply interested in having someone look at it, authenticate it, maybe have a second opinion of what it is because it's in a different language, we can do that as well.
I wondered always, too, is like, did you ever, I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, South Florida is, you know, a very large population of a Jewish community, but really of Holocaust survivors. And did you ever find out why this was the place that they wanted to come to, or how they ended up here?
I think a lot of survivors end up in South Florida for a few reasons. One is there is a large retirement community here. I do meet a lot of people in retirement communities. Additionally, the weather is obviously a draw for anyone in South Florida. And I think over time, a lot of Jewish Holocaust survivors who would visit Florida as snowbirds over time would just move here. And yeah, I think the Jewish population here, having the survivors, second and third generation family members in Florida, is a draw to be closer to family.
And again, if people think they have stories, I mean, they have stories, or if they have any items, then basically just reach out to you, find you. As we mentioned on our Facebook page, WLR and Sundial, we do have a link there. Please check it out. And if you think you do, or if there's, it's finally that time to share a story, then, you know, please reach out to Amy because she is trying to collect as much of that history as possible. On average, I'm just curious, on average, how many people do you get to meet with, I guess, every week, every month?
Definitely depends on the week, but I would say approximately I try to meet with at least two people a week. But like I said, the museum is proactively looking for more people now. And since we've been getting some press since I've started, my phone has been ringing off the hook. So I imagine I'll be meeting people daily as time goes on.
Yeah. By the way, and just to note, the museum has been impacted by the shutdown, hasn't it?
Yes, partially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anybody who has had the chance to go, if not get up there, but I mean, for you, you're still able to keep, you're still going.
Yes, thankfully. I'm still working as many hours as I can to meet as many survivors as I can, because the museum is really not just preserving the past. Something that's really important is creating the future of education.
Amy Rubenstein, South Florida curator for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. A reminder that WLR and Broward reporter Katie Swatolsky is doing extensive coverage of this story, and it's going to air on Monday, so stay tuned for that. Amy, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much, and continued great work.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, who were the Florida Highwaymen and how did they become some of Florida's most prolific artists? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, for those who don't know the story of the Florida Highwaymen, their journey is among the most remarkable in the state's history. A group of 26 African-American painters with little training or knowledge of landscape art made a living for themselves traveling along Florida's Highway 1, creating and selling paintings over the course of several decades. Now, the group of 25 men and one woman originated from the Fort Pierce area. Their paintings have played an essential role in capturing the state's landscape in the mid-20th century. Now, some of the original painters are continuing their work to this day, and several of the group's pieces will be on display at the Levis JCC Phyllis and Harvey Sandler Center in Boca Raton this weekend. Now, noted author and photographer Gary Monroe will be speaking at the exhibition this Sunday alongside one of the original highwaymen, Al Black. Monroe joins us now for some more of the historical context on this group, and it's such a pleasure. Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, take us back to the origins of the Highwaymen. How did this group get their start?
Spontaneous combustion. In the late 1950s, there was one of the young painters, Alfred Hare, who was the dreamer, and this is in the height of Jim Crow, Florida. And he decided he wanted to be a millionaire by his 35th birthday and do it through his artwork. And he invited others to join him, and it sure beat picking fruit in the nearby groves. And by and large, he just taught themselves to paint, as Marianne Carroll, the only female highway person, commented, "We learned from one another's brushes." So they're sort of self-taught in the community. They made their oil paintings and took them on the road and had the audacity of hope in the 1960s to knock on strangers' doors, lawyers, doctors, accountants, the phone companies, et cetera, et cetera. And the paintings just sold quickly. People loved their imagery, and they were sort of like trophies identifying why people made Florida home. And they had a 20-year run, and during which time they perhaps sold up to, some, by some estimates, a 250,000 oil paintings.
Who was A.E. Backus, and what was his role in the painter's development?
Backus is a white regionalist painter from Fort Pierce, very, very well known. Had a lot of clients in Miami. There are still some of his paintings at the Riviera Country Club and Basker Palmer Eye Clinic. But he was perhaps the quintessential regionalist in the state of Florida. And he had a very open door policy at that time and invited Alfred, taught Alfred Hare to paint, in fact, gave him Saturday morning painting lessons when Alfred was still in high school and encouraged Alfred. And he served as the model by which the highwaymen realized what images were most likely marketable. And they went about painting similar scenes, but in a very different approach, a very different style.
And they were painting basically they're painting Florida landscapes. But what were they capturing? What was the landscape that they were capturing at the time?
They were painting their environment. They were painting the South Florida coastal scenes, the interior scenes, the backwater scenes, under beautiful light, and with a very optimistic aura. It was also in the time of the space race, and it was post-war Florida. People were flocking here. It was a very optimistic time. And I think these paintings of natural Florida without the accoutrements of man-made things really appealed to our visceral selves. And it was no wonder they sold like hotcakes at $25 a painting. And at the same time, Backus and other professional painters were charging approximately $250 for their paintings. So at one-tenth the price, they were very affordable to the masses. And that's who bought these paintings. You know, imagine buying a property or home sight unseen in Florida after the war and coming down here and perhaps being disillusioned by the heat, the humidity, cockroaches, mosquitoes before the wilds were tamed. And you take one of these still glowing paintings and hanging it on your cinder block wall, and you transformed it into a picture window into the paradise that lured you here from Ohio or New Jersey, et cetera. They were everywhere for a good 20-year run. And then they went dormant. In the early 1980s, they lost favor. I suspect that the cultures had shifted and tastes had changed. And the artists had given up their enterprise by and large, and the paintings sort of faded and were allocated to garages and closets.
Let's talk about one of the artists, specifically Alfred Hare. He's one of the key painters within the original Highwaymen group. Why was he revered as one of the most talented of the painters?
He was perhaps the most original. Alfred Hare was, as I said, a dreamer, a complete optimist, charismatic. When I interviewed his fellow painters for the first book, guys in their 60s and 70s back then were getting teary-eyed just remembering him. Women were still swooning over him. He was, by all accounts, a movie star handsome with a heart of gold. And he wanted to be rich. He didn't want to be known as an artist. And in fact, he went about corrupting all those cherished concerns of academic romanticized landscape paintings that had lost favor well before he entered the scene. They weren't on the cutting edge of anything. It wasn't his issue. He just wanted to make money. So what Alfred did is by charging 1/10 of what a painting would otherwise go for by a gallery artist, he had to paint really fast to make up for the shortfall of cash. So he would charge $25 per painting, but he would make 10 paintings in the same time it would take a professional artist to make one. What he didn't account for was that by painting so quickly, he would invariably corrupt those cherished values and arrive at a much fresher and, I argue, more relevant form of contemporary painting than had been the model. So I do argue that he's an important artist beyond the wonderful narrative story of what the artists left and what their paintings mean.
I want to get a sense, too, of, you know, how these guys were selling their work. So I'd imagine, like, say, if I'm at my home or I'm there in Fort Pierce in the 1960s, I see Alfred Hare approach me. I mean, what's the process for selling this work? I get it. It's cheaper than if I'm buying something, you know, maybe from a different kind of artist. But how are they selling this?
Well, they were knocking on. They weren't going door to door in residential neighborhoods. Nor were they setting up at gas stations like they were selling chenille bedspreads. They would knock at professional offices and very deferentially ask if they can show their paintings. And they were like calling cards. So they would go to lawyers' office, doctors' offices, hardware stores, anything that lined US-1. And not only in Fort Pierce, but all the way up through Daytona Beach to Jacksonville. And Alfred loved to peddle his paintings in Fort Lauderdale and down into Miami. And they would simply ask permission, show these paintings. And at that point, the paintings pretty much sold themselves. People were just attracted to them because of their sublime beauty and message.
And yeah, and I you know, wanted to just mention too, because I was thinking about, you know, if you have like a gallery well-known painter, like a Bacchus, you know, you would spend more money. But here's some guy who's coming up to you and he's offering you a painting and it's lovely. And it's cheaper. And so I was curious as to how he was doing that. But again, I'm talking with Gary Monroe, noted photographer and author behind the book, The Highwaymen, Florida's African-American Landscape Painters. He's sharing the history of the iconic Florida Highwaymen, 25 men and one woman who went door to door selling paintings in the Jim Crow era while with little or no formal training, by the way. There's a special exhibition at the Levis JCC Phyllis and Harvey Sandler Center in Boca Raton, featuring 40 of the Florida Highwaymen paintings. Monroe will be speaking at an event there on Sunday, along with one of the original Highwaymen, Al Black. The Highwaymen continued their success through the 70s, and then there was a tragedy that occurred, and it was at Eddie's Bar in Fort Pierce, and you visited that bar. Tell us what happened that day and the impact that it had on the Highwaymen.
Sure. August 9, 1970, a Sunday evening, and Alfred Hare was out with one of his buddies, a fellow painter, Livingston Roberts. Eddie's was a juke joint, an old-fashioned juke joint. And I can envision what it was like that night, perhaps the only place open along Avenue D in Fort Pierce, the black part of Fort Pierce. And just crowded, full of smoke, round tables, a bar, two jukeboxes, and people cavorting left and right, spilling out onto the sidewalk. It must have been a very cinematic scene. And long story short, although Alfred had a heart of gold and a generous spirit, not a bad bone in his body, he was also quite the ladies' man. And one of the field hands who was jealous came up to Livingston Roberts and said, your buddy Alfred gets more attention from my girlfriend than I do, and young people are going a little bit stupid. And long story short, he walks out and comes back with a pistol, and he hits Livingston across the face, knocks his beer out of his hand, and Livingston walks away and turns to Alfred and makes some crude remark to him, and Alfred doesn't know what he's talking about. And next thing, man pulls the trigger and shoots Alfred Hare in the chest. And Alfred stumbles out the side door where the cars are parked, and man chases him, and they tussle a little bit, and he runs off, and Alfred walks through the front of Eddie's place to his car, bleeding profusely, and his friends drive him to the hospital where he's dead on arrival. 29 years old, the top of his game, and the father of six children, and the man responsible for creating the visual legacy of modern Florida. It's a story that Steven Spielberg cannot make up or improve on. He dies. And as Hezekiah Baker, one of the painters, said, Alfred was the glue that held us together. But there was so much centrifugal force at that time that the painters remained active for one more decade until things went dormant.
Some of the highwayman painters are continuing to this day, and many of their paintings are selling, I mean, now for thousands of dollars. But what's contributed to their popularity in the art market?
Two things. When they were doing their thing, they had no name. They were just this loose association of like-minded young people having the time of their lives. You know, Alfred's interim goal on his road to becoming a millionaire was to have a Cadillac. And he had a Cadillac, and his friends had Cadillacs. They were just living this great life, setting up bars all up and down the East Coast, and coming back every afternoon with hundreds and hundreds of dollars. It was a great life. But they had no name, no organization, no rules, no dues. And when it goes dormant, it goes dormant. And paintings were, over the years, being found at yard sales for $1, $2, $3 a piece. In 1994, an arts gallerist from Sebring, Florida, named Jim Fitch, got wind of what had happened because he's friends with one of the painters. And he went down to visit Fort Pierce, and he simply dubbed them the Highwaymen. So suddenly they had a name, and once they had a name, they could be commodified. And I got interested in it by the same time and decided to take some time off to write this book. And I think the name and then the book really brought everything together. And since then, it's been this cultural explosion. And you're quite right. Paintings that were $25 new and later $2 or $3 or $4 at yard sales or flea markets can now sell for $2,500 and even $25,000 a piece.
Yeah.
And of course, it brought the painters out of retirement. You know, I used to offer the painters gratis canvas and oils and brushes, and they would categorically say thank you, but that was in the past. But once said the book came out and they saw a renewed market, like dominoes falling one after the again, to great acclaim and financial success.
Gary Monroe, again, noted photographer and author. He's author of the book, The Highwaymen, Florida's African-American Landscape Painters. And again, he's sharing the history of the iconic Florida Highwaymen, 25 men, one woman who went door-to-door selling paintings in the Jim Crow era. A special exhibition at the Levis JCC Phyllis and Harvey Sandler Center in Boca Raton starting this weekend, runs through the end of the month. And Gary, again, is going to be speaking on Sunday. Gary, it's such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much for sharing the stories.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And before we end the show, when it comes to making New Year's resolutions, is one of yours, by the way, to read more? Because I know mine is. I'm going to try to read 50 books this year. I'll see if I can get close to that. How about joining a book club? Well, how about this? Join the Sundial Book Club. You can join for free on Facebook. Yesterday, we announced the January title. It is Jesus Boy by Preston Allen. Preston is a professor at North Miami-Dade College, and we're really excited about starting to read his book, and we welcome Preston to the book club. So if you haven't joined, remember, just find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. Click to join. We'd love to have you, and you get to virtually meet the authors and discuss the book of the month, which, of course, all of us have to do this with South Florida. All the books have to do with South Florida, and we welcome everybody, so please do it. Lastly, we talked about the history of South Florida hip-hop on the program yesterday, three artists with ties to the region's hip-hop scene here at Nova Southeastern University's Art Museum for a symposium. That's today, by the way, and they're talking about this musical history beginning at 6 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. On social media, we asked our listeners, what were the hip-hop songs of your childhood? And we got some funny comments. Tanya Ott told us, I grew up in Gainesville in the 80s and clearly remember taking a road trip with my parents and my younger brother to Virginia. Dad was driving and had control of the cassette player. Oh, I missed those. And after a bit of nagging from my brother, who was probably 12 or 13 at the time, my dad agreed to let him play the cassette, his cassette. And when he pressed play, well, we got a little too live crude. Needless to say, the next time my brother was allowed to commandeer the stereo system was when he owned his own car. You can go to our Instagram at WLRN and look up photos of the artists who are going to be at that symposium, by the way, so check it out. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.